Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John. What's happening?
Dude, are we coming out of the frozen tundra that is Kentucky right now?
I don't know. I think it's a little melted today, but I know like Florida is buried in snow. The California has been on fire. It's just America's kind of a mess, weather and disaster speaking.
Yeah, it's hard to complain about the cold when so many folks have lost their homes over in California. Our thoughts and prayers continue to be with those. North Carolina still hasn't recovered. South Carolina, Tennessee, all those impacted by the hurricane that somehow devastated inland because of flooding. This is crazy times, Jamie.
It is, but thankfully we're thawing out here, and we're thawing out to a fantastic case. Before we jump in, I do need to give a big thanks to a couple people who wrote 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts. This comes from Charlize26. Says, thank you for the clear and passionate reporting on the lives of victims of crime and the survivors, as well as the beasts that torment them. Charlize, that is very well written. If you want a job, hit us up. This one comes from Agent Scully Rose. This is an excellent podcast. I love the two hosts so much. They have great voices, interesting stories, excellent attention to detail, interesting facts, and side stories provided. Overall, extremely entertaining. Thank you, Agent Scully Rose. If you're a real agent, let us know. We got a job for you.
I love that. That is those are two good games, like two good pick-me-ups. So I appreciate it.
Those were very kind. Thank you so much for that.
January is one of the craziest months of the year for me. I've got staff evaluations from 2024 to do. I have grant reporting that I have to do. Just everything is kind of the perfect storm that settles in the month of January. This year has been totally different. I feel cool, calm, and collected, and I really do think it's because of my ability to take Magic Mind every single day. But I think a big reason that my health and wellness is doing so good right now is what they offer at night. Magic Mind has a product for nighttime called the Magic Sleep Elixir, which is just something that helps me to settle my racing mind at night and find myself in a deep, comfortable sleep that allows me to wake up refreshed. And then taking Magic Mind on top of that is just a win-win situation for me, dude, that doesn't leave me with a crash. It is something that is nice and just leaves me with a clear mind and a cool heart.
There, that's very well put. And you can have a cool mind and cool heart. How'd you say that?
Calm and cool.
Calm and cool as well. You can get 45% off Magic Mind bundle with the link MagicMind.com/VIP, JANJAN. So that is MagicMind.com/VIP, JANJAN for January. So go check that out and get your Magic Mind, and then tell us how right we were about how awesome it is.
All right, man. We have a case that I know you're particularly excited to talk about, and it's one that I love for the reasons of I just love history. So this is an older case, but a very important one to American history. With that being said, why don't you get the ball rolling?
Yeah, we're going to talk about the very first murder trial in the United States of America. And I honestly learned about this through Hamilton, the musical. I'll play a little clip from that later on. But this is Alexander Hamilton's involved, Aaron Burr's involved. And it's a good case. Like, it's not just notable for that reason, but it's very interesting in the details of what happened. And I mentioned to my daughter that we were going to be covering this. She loves musicals. And she was like, wait, you have a crime podcast and you've never covered the first murder trial in America? What's wrong with you? Well, like, thank you, teenager. Point. Thank you, teenager.
Also, Hamilton's probably one of her favorite things of all time.
It is. Indeed. And this case is brought up in there. Actually, I'll go ahead and play that clip if that's okay with you, John.
Absolutely.
Cool? So this is from Hamilton the musical, and it introduces the case about the trial of Levi Weeks.
Gentlemen of the jury, I'm curious, bear with me. Are you aware that we're making history? This is the first murder trial of our brand new nation, the liberty behind the liberation. I intend to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt with my assistant counsel.
Co-counsel Hamilton, sit down. A client every week's is innocent. Call your first witness. That's all you had to say.
Okay, one more thing. Why do you...
There you go.
I never would have dreamed that we would be two guys playing sections of a musical on our true crime podcast.
Yeah.
That's where we are, though.
Things are weird. Things are weird.
I love it. I love that play and that it is like historically accurate.
Mostly. There are some people who have qualms with it, but it is super well done and very historical, like you said, as is this case. So we're going back to 19th century New York City, the Manhattan Well murder. This has secrets, betrayal, heartbreak, all in the backdrop of New York City, where it was rapidly growing. The victim in this case is Guillelma, who we'll refer to as Elma Sands, a young woman whose death really shocked the area in 1799. Her mysterious disappearance and the discovery of her body in the Manhattan Well would spark one of the most sensational trials in early American history and, like I said, the very first murder trial in these United States of America.
Elma Sands was 22 years old. She was living in Greenwich Street Boarding House, which was a group home basically ran by a Quaker couple. Their names were Catherine and Elias Ring. The Ring's home was a bustling place. It was filled with boarders from different walks of life, including a young carpenter named Levi Weeks.
Yeah, let's talk about Levi Weeks. He was born in 1776, so the year the Declaration of Independence was signed. He was born in Massachusetts. He had kind of a humble background, but he was part of a family that was really well known for being ambitious and hardworking. Levi's older brother, Ezra Weeks, was a key figure in Levi's life, and their relationship actually played a pretty key role in this case.
Ezra was a successful builder in New York City. By the late 18th century, Ezra had established himself as one of the city's premier contractors. He was working on projects like the new construction on Les Pinard's Meadow, which is where the Manhattan Wall was located, or the Manhattan Well, sorry. Levi worked under Ezra's guidance, which was, you know, allowing him a chance to hone his skills as a carpenter.
By all accounts, Levi was quiet. He was a good worker. His connection to Ezra meant that he was fairly well connected, but it also meant that he had resources that he could use, which came in especially handy when he was accused of murder. And these were resources that most people would not have had in his situation.
Before the events of December 1799, Levi Weeks lived as a boarder in the Ring household on Greenwich Street. Elias and Catherine Ring were prominent Quakers, as I said earlier, who operated the boarding house, and their home was busy. There were young people like Weeks and others who were professionals and were kind of enjoying the atmosphere of the home because they had friends and even romances could blossom in this home. Among the other boarders was Elma Sands. She was described by others to be a kind-spirited woman. Elma and Levi seemed to develop a connection, though accounts differ on the nature of their relationship. Some folks described it as a courtship, but others suggested that it was just flirtation, that they were just being nice and flirty with each other.
It's interesting to me to think back to that time and to imagine people sneaking around to date. I don't know. I feel like back then everything was super formal and everybody was really proper, but not really the case.
Is that when they called it courting?
Yes. Yeah, it was a courtship, some believed. So what we do know is that Elma told her cousin, whose name was Hope Sands, that she did have feelings for Levi. On the night of her disappearance, Hope claimed that Elma was excited and told her they had plans to elope to get married. Levi would deny any romantic relationship beyond just a casual friendship with Elma, specifically after he was accused of her murder. And this discrepancy was a key point in the case against them. Were they or were they not romantically involved? Hope says that Elma certainly thought they were. She was dressed in her finest clothes. Every time she went to meet him, she got all prettied up and was out to impress. But on December 22nd of 1799, just 3 days before Christmas, Elba did not come home. Hours turned into days, and her absence started to really concern everybody around. Keep in mind, 1700s, no cell phones, no pagers, no GPS. The boarders started whispering amongst themselves, asking, what happened? Did they elope? But then, of course, Levi was still around. So had she run off on her own? Or had something else happen to Elma, and they needed to find out what?
Hope was definitely worried. She was convinced that something terrible had happened. And so, of course, Levi was questioned, but he denied knowing anything about her whereabouts and claimed that he had nothing to do with her disappearance. 11 days later, so this would be January 2nd, 1800. That's like a new millennia, right? We saw that. In 2000.
So Y2K, I bet this was a bigger deal.
It was, but this particular day was a big deal because this mystery about her whereabouts took a very dark turn. Workers near the Manhattan Well, which was near that meadow, which was a remote area outside of the city, noticed something unusual. The well was part of a new development. It was meant to provide fresh water for the growing population of New York City. But upon closer inspection, they made a horrifying discovery. Floating in the frigid water was the body of a young woman, and news of this discovery, of course, spread quickly, and soon the authorities were on the scene to take a closer look.
It didn't take long for the body to be identified as that of Elma Sands. Her family was devastated, and the public was outraged. Elma had been missing for nearly 2 weeks, and now the mystery of her disappearance had turned into a murder mystery.
The well itself became an instant symbol of horror. At the time, New York City was still a small community, and the tragedy felt very personal to many folks. People gathered near the site with the intentions of finding answers. They were desperate. As the investigation began, the focus quickly turned to Levi Weeks. Several boarders at the Ring House came forward with statements that cast suspicion and doubt on him and whether or not his stories of not having anything to do with her disappearance were true. The people recalled seeing Levi and Elma together on the night of her disappearance, and they were leaving the house at the same time, or at least around the same time.
Yeah, so this is when Hope came forward and told people about the allegedly planned elopement of Elma and Levi. And it just confirmed what a lot of other people thought, is that Levi had lured Elma away, potentially under the ruse of an elopement, and then done something with her. There were whispers about Levi's behavior after Elma disappeared. Some people said he was unusually calm and quiet, and others at the boarding house were frantic with worry. Levi's denial of involvement only caused more whispers behind the scenes to happen and to tell the people living in the house that maybe he really did have something to hide.
Adding to this story was some intrigue regarding Levi's connection to his older brother, Ezra, who again was a prominent builder in New York. Ezra's wealth and influence raised questions about whether Levi might avoid justice. You know, think about people that are well-to-do and influential, sometimes they don't face accountability for their actions. But despite Ezra's status, public sentiment was turning against Levi, and the authorities decided to go ahead and charge him with murder. So to really understand the magnitude of this crime, I think it's important to consider the setting. New York in 1800, especially New York City, was not the New York City that it is today. It was still a bustling hub of people, but it was much smaller than it is now. It had a population of around 60,000 people. So the city was expanding rapidly, but it was still a tightly knit community. And even without the technology of today, news traveled fast and the community was quick to judge. Jamie, I don't really know the population of the city that we live in right now, but it's similar to what we're talking about as to New York City in the early 1800s. So I can imagine, yes, even the town my size, it from where I grew up, it was considered a large town, but 60,000 people, everybody knows everybody, especially if you're prominent. Like, I know if I want a house built, there are like three reputable builders in my community. I will call one of them. And that's the same thing we have here.
It really is. And it's funny that things spread so quickly. You didn't have social media. There were some publications, but even those were put out periodically. They didn't have a daily newspaper or anything like that. And the current population of New York is over 8 million people. So
a little different.
Little bit different. The Manhattan Well, where Elma's body was found, was located in what was then the outskirts of the city. This is an important piece here. It was a part of a development that was being run and operated by Aaron Burr, who was a co-counsel for Levi Weeks in this case, and probably most famous for killing Alexander Hamilton in a duel. They both ended up playing key roles in Weeks' defense, like we heard in the clip from Hamilton, the musical, a little bit earlier. But for now, the focus remained on the crime itself. Elma's death raised questions about safety, trust, and how could one protect oneself in a growing metropolis like we were seeing in New York City? The community demanded answers, and there was pressure on the authorities to deliver justice. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about Levi's arrest, how the public reacted, and what this looked like when it finally went to trial.
After Levi's arrest, the case continued to capture public attention. Newspapers back then were a big deal, and I low-key wish that we could get back to that. I'm really loving my newspapers.com subscription, and we have some exciting projects to come up with that. But
extra, read all about it.
But the newspapers reported on every detail, from the discovery of Elma's body to even the accusations against Levi. There was really nothing off limits with the newspapers, and I'm here for it. I love it. It's like the Reddit, but on paper.
Reddit paper.
So the well itself became a grim tourist attraction later and drew curious onlookers. I said later, I mean, like right after her body was discovered.
Right, yeah, immediately.
Meanwhile, Elma's family was left to grieve. For Hope Sands and the Rings, her death was a personal tragedy, compounded by the belief that Levi had betrayed their trust. Hope, in particular, became a vocal advocate for justice, and she was determined. She was set in her heart to see Levi held accountable.
So you have this group that really wants to see Levi held accountable and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. On the other side, you have Ezra Weeks, again, a well-known guy, had a lot of money, and he was determined to save his younger brother. So he put together this dream team of defense attorneys: Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and Henry Brockholst Livingston were the defense team. The inclusion of Hamilton and Burr is fascinating given their famous duel, and really the musical does a great job of delving into their relationship. At this time, they were respected colleagues in the legal field and a bit of political rivals, but obviously they weren't bitter enemies yet. Their decision to work together on Levi's case highlighted the stakes involved and the influence that Ezra Weeks wielded in that community.
I think it's worth noting that this defense team was really unprecedented for the time, in that the star power on the case was just insane. For a young carpenter who was accused of murder, having these legal giants like Hamilton and Burr on his side seemed almost too good to be true. And keep in mind, this was unprecedented because this was the very first murder trial in the country, in the entire United States, where everyone was still finding their way. So even having a defense attorney was somewhat of a new concept. So fascinating case in that regard.
And they very much were continuing to find their way throughout the case.
Despite his high-profile defense team, Levi still faced an uphill battle. The evidence against him was largely circumstantial, but the court of public opinion had already convicted him. So Elma's tragic death had struck a nerve, and many saw Levi as the perfect scapegoat. They thought it was him, so they thought he needed swift justice.
Yeah, and they were all on board with this. Circumstantial. I mean, again, we don't have DNA. We don't have cameras. We have some eyewitness testimony that saw them together, but circumstantial evidence is about all you can have in a case like this, right?
Yeah. I mean, especially for the time period, because like you said, there's no such thing as DNA. Now, if you were to happen to see him soon before her body was discovered and noticed scratches or blood on his clothing, then that might be considered physical evidence. But in this situation, I think circumstantial is the best case scenario.
His demeanor during the actual trial added another layer of mystery to all this. He maintained his innocence, but he was incredibly quiet and reserved, and people interpreted his silence as guilt. John, I was called to jury duty again for like the third time a few weeks ago. In the jury selection process, the judge hammered home the defendant does not have to speak or offer a single piece of evidence, and you still have to assume he's guilty or he's innocent until the prosecution proves otherwise to you. So at the time, again, we're still figuring all this out. So people were presuming he was guilty, even though they're supposed to have the presumption of innocence. Critics accused him of being emotionless, while his defenders argued that he was simply overwhelmed by the situation. He was also sad that his friend Elma had been killed, and he just wanted out of this situation to get on with his life. Notably, at this point, defendants weren't even allowed to take the stand in their own defense. So his lack of defending himself publicly was in accordance with the law at that time. The media played a significant role in shaping Levi's image, which is hard to think about. You mentioned the newspapers. They all depicted him as either a cold-blooded killer or a victim of circumstance. So he did have some support in the media, but it made him a really polarizing figure, and it did nothing but build speculation and anticipation for this trial that was going to be happening. Again, the first murder trial in America.
Adding to the tension was the social divide in New York City. So at the time, Levi's case became a symbol of the growing gap between the wealthy elite class and the working class. For many, this was not a case about just simply justice for Alma Sands, but it was about holding powerful men like Ezra Weeks accountable. For a long time, they felt above the law, and there wasn't a really good court system to work these cases, to work other, you know, lesser crimes. So this was almost, I don't know, a symbol of right versus wrong and the weak versus the strong almost. The courtroom itself was also full of drama. Nobody really knew the rules or the order. So the trial was kind of a mess, which is really a shame because this was a very important and fascinating case in and of itself. The trial against Levi Weeks began on March 31st, 1800 in the court there in New York City. And this was no ordinary trial. Like we said over and over, this was the first murder trial in the United States. It's spectacular. And you would have to imagine that they would have to recognize this as a pivotal case that people are going to be looking at, because that they're not barbarians. They had a court system in England, you know, so they had some idea that this was going to be a big deal. So I really don't understand why there wasn't some rules established beforehand, maybe, but regardless, I think some things came up that were just like, oh, okay, well, let's do it this way.
Yeah, there were some, of course, but for example, the defense didn't do their opening statement until after the prosecution presented their entire case. There were people asking questions from the crowd, like, the transcript of this is available online, and it's a hot mess.
I love that. The public's interest was definitely understandable. Alma Sands' death had been gruesome and mysterious, and Levi Weeks, again a young carpenter with ties to the New York elites, was the perfect centerpiece for a story of scandal and intrigue.
And like we said, the star power was there. You have Hamilton and Burr, and the third attorney, Henry Livingston, who I had never heard of before then, ended up being on the Supreme Court. So this is really a group of highly intellectual, highly influential people in the legal world. But it wasn't just a battle of legal minds. It was also for public opinion. The prosecution, who was led by Attorney General Cadwallader David Colden, painted Levi as a cunning murderer. Meanwhile, the defense team sought to dismantle the case with logic, evidence, and theatrics. They're trying to create reasonable doubt, and they're doing it with every tool they have in their toolkit. The prosecution's narrative was pretty straightforward. They argued that Levi lured Elma Sands away, telling him they were going to elope on the night of December 22nd, 1799. Something happened when they got there. Maybe he was just looking for a way to end the relationship, but he killed her when they got there, and he was either trying to cover up a scandal or to avoid a commitment that he didn't want to make to her.
Yeah, I don't know what else would drive him to do this. Some other things that come to my mind is maybe he made an advance on her that she didn't want, and when she refused, things could have got violent. It's all speculation. Who knows?
That's certainly possible. We say that a lot now. So again, it's something that very well could have happened.
There were testimonies from residents from the Ring boarding house where Levi and Elma both lived. And they said that, or one of them, Hope, testified that Elma confided her plans to elope with Levi. Hope described how Elma had left the house excitedly that evening and then never came back. Another boarder from the home claimed to have seen Levi and Elma together that night, heading towards the meadow, the Les Pinards meadow, where she was ultimately found. And this testimony placed Levi near the Manhattan Well, which was the crime scene. So the prosecution also introduced circumstantial evidence, such as Levi's calm demeanor in the days following Elma's disappearance, which they argued was inconsistent with innocence.
Yeah, which is tough. I mean, we talk all the time that it's hard to really interpret how somebody should react to something like this, but the prosecution had their challenges. The evidence was largely eyewitness, circumstantial stuff, which then was probably trusted a lot more now than it is now, or a lot more than it should be. Some even admitted that they hadn't even seen Levi and Elma together that night, that they had just heard about it. The lack of concrete proof left room for the all-star defense team to creep in some reasonable doubt, and they took full advantage of all these inconsistencies. They were master strategists, Hamilton, Burr, and Livingston. Their approach to this case was calculated and theatrical, and many would say that the prosecuting attorney, Cadwallader David Colden, was in over his head against these brilliant legal minds.
This is like O.J. Simpson's defense team. I mean, this is the best of the best.
I would almost, you say that just because he had that defense, but all of it, like the if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Like, I think it was that type of presentation the defense made that really took the jury and the crowd by, I don't know, it captivated them.
Like, so not only the high profile, just status of the attorneys, but also their almost theatrical performance. Absolutely. during the trial. So they began attacking the credibility of the prosecution's witness. For instance, they pointed out contradictions in testimonies about Levi's whereabouts on the nights of the murder. They also questioned the reliability of Hope Sands. They suggested that her grief in the loss of her family member and maybe arguably best friend might have clouded her memory. The defense's most significant move was presenting an alternative theory. They argued that someone else had killed Elma, that Levi was just the scapegoat for this crime. They pointed to other individuals who had been near the well around the same time that Elma had disappeared, implying that the real killer might still be on the large and needs to be held accountable. I think one of the most compelling arguments revolved around the physical evidence, or lack thereof. They highlighted the absence of blood or signs of a struggle near the well. If Levi had killed Elma and thrown her into the well, wouldn't there be more evidence to support that claim? Like I mentioned earlier, did he have any scratches on him in the days after her attack or her disappearance? Was there any physical signs out there that maybe Levi hadn't done this?
Did they find any bloody clothes back at his house? Did he have any clothing with her body? I mean, I think the answers to those were no, but that's what they were looking for. Several witnesses took the stand during this trial, and again, they're still figuring all this out, so it's very hectic. But there were two testimonies that really stood out. The first person on the stand was Catherine Ring. Again, she was the matron of the boarding house where both Levi and Elma lived. Catherine testified about tensions in the household leading up to Elma's disappearance, painting Levi in a suspicious light. Another interesting moment when she was on the stand is when her husband, Elias Ring, was removed from the courtroom. He was actually standing behind his wife and quote-unquote helping her with her testimony publicly. They would ask her a question, and he would say out loud what she should say. So the prosecution objected. They ended up removing him. Again, an absolute mess. The second key testimony came from somebody who claimed to have seen a figure near the well on the night of the murder. He had initially identified Levi as the figure, but later admitted to the court under scrutiny from Hamilton and Burr that he couldn't be sure. And this wavering back and forth undermined the prosecution's entire case and really, I don't know, gave the defense a foothold to plant that reasonable doubt.
Throughout the trial, Hamilton and Burr masterfully cross-examined witnesses, exposing inconsistencies and casting doubt on their reliability. Their skillful questioning often left the prosecution scrambling to recover, and there is a reason they were the founding fathers. They were, in fact, brilliant litigators. In their closing arguments, the prosecutions reiterated their belief that Levi Weeks was guilty. They appealed to the jury's emotions, urging them to deliver justice for Elma Sands and to give her family, who was grieving, justice that they deserved. And he was the only real suspect. Nobody else had brought any accusations against anyone, so why not go all in on Levi? And they truly believed that he was guilty.
The defense, on the other hand, focused on reason, logic, and doubt. Hamilton, in particular, emphasized the lack of direct evidence that linked Levi to the crime. He reminded the jury that convicting an innocent man would be a grave miscarriage of justice and set the legal system, like paint a horrible mark on it and set horrible precedents for moving forward. Burr's argument was just as compelling. He pointed out the societal implications of convicting Levi without solid proof, framing the case as a test of the jury's commitment to fairness and due process, even though a lot of people were making this out to be an issue of lower society versus the wealthier people in town.
After days of testimony and then hours of deliberation, the jury was tasked with presenting their verdict. And on April 2nd, 1800, Levi Weeks was acquitted of all charges, and the courtroom erupted in shock and mixed reactions to this news. For some, this verdict was seen as a triumph of justice and proof that the legal system was able to work with the ability to uphold the principle of innocent until proven guilty. But for others, this was a travesty. This was a stark example of, again, how wealth and privilege could provide a shield of justice and accountability. So, yeah, lots of mixed emotions here.
Levi's life after this was never the same. Though he was acquitted, the public still had it out for him. Everybody was still suspicious of him. He eventually had to leave New York. He moved to Natchez, Mississippi, where he built a new life and became a respected architect. As for this case itself, it remains one of America's earliest true crime stories. The questions surrounding Elma Sands' death and Levi Weeks' involvement continue to fascinate historians and now true crime enthusiasts alike. The Manhattan Well murder was more than just a legal proceeding. It was a snapshot of everything happening in early American society in the growing city of New York City, with all of the complexities and contradictions of balancing freedom with order, of balancing justice with letting people have free will and developing systems. It highlighted issues of class, gender, and justice that still resonate with us today.
So, I mean, it's been over 200 years, of course, since this trial, and I think it's awesome that we have the full transcript of it, what was America's first murder trial. Jamie, you're on the jury. let's pretend, what would you do? What vote would you cast?
You know, this is tough because looking back at it, knowing, I mean, I hate to beat on the guy, but the prosecutor was very unmatched. He was out of his league. And I think the brilliant defense attorneys won the case for weeks. I think he was probably guilty. However, is there reasonable doubt? There absolutely is reasonable doubt. And there absolutely was reasonable doubt painted in the courtroom by these brilliant defense attorneys. So I think if you're on that jury, there is not evidence beyond a reasonable doubt and you had to acquit. But if this was preponderance of evidence, more probable than not, I would say he probably did it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Occam's razor, right? I mean, he probably did it, but I'm not going to send him to, I mean, he would have been found on capital murder charges, right?
Yeah, he probably would have been hanged that day.
Yeah. So I'm not going to put him in the noose because definitely don't have enough evidence to feel good about that later that night when I try to sleep. So
yeah, absolutely. I think there would have to be a literal smoking gun of some kind, or he would have to be caught red-handed in this situation. Or like I said, maybe some of her blood found on his clothes back in his room, or some of his stuff found at the crime scene, but none of that existed. So I think reasonable doubt did win out here, as it should have. But this was really, there's actually a podcast out there that does a dramatic reenactment of this case that I highly recommend for people. It is called Erased: The Murder of Elma Sands. And it does, really, for me, it painted a picture of how chaotic the courtroom was at the time. And I think that was very interesting to take a look at. To hear the script being acted out by people was a lot of fun. So go check that out for sure. But it is our first murder crime, our first controversial acquittal of the American legal system. And guess what? We're still getting it wrong, getting it right. It's still, it's not as perfect as I think we all want it to be, but I don't think it can be.
It's not a fast process anymore as fast as I would like it to be. But I do think that by and large, I think it is a process that is still effective and is working. Have they always been right? Probably not. Will that ever change? I don't think so. But it is a good, it's the system that I think is the best one we could have.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're doing our best. It's not always, it's never perfect. It's not always right. It's wrong quite a bit, but I think we've talked about this quite a bit. To err on the side of, is it better to put an innocent person in jail or let a guilty person walk free? It is better to let a guilty person walk free. So I think reasonable doubt is a great standard, and they stuck to it here. But John, big piece of history here, something that had I not listened to Hamilton, the musical, and then gone out and find this transcript, I would have never found out about this. But it is a huge piece of our history and our legal system. And true crime is such a big thing. I don't know why it's not talked about more, but maybe we can get that rolling.
Yeah, this was a good one, Jamie. Thanks for bringing it to us, man.
Guys, we appreciate you so much. If you don't mind, leaving us a review is really the best thing you can do for us over on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on social media, wherever you can do that would be wonderful. You know what? Just text an episode to a friend. Say, hey, check this out. Share it on your social media. We put everything out there, but we appreciate you all very much.
That'd make my heart happy. Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.